Broadcasting from Baltimore, Maryland, and all around the world, you're listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. Tune in each Thursday on iTunes for the latest episodes of the Stansberry Investor Hour. Sign up for the free show archive at investorhour.com. Here is your host, Dan Ferris.
Hello and welcome to the Stansberry Investor Hour. I'm your host, Dan Ferris. I'm also the editor of Extreme Value, a value investing service published by Stansberry Research. This week I'm in Las Vegas at the annual Stansberry Conference, having a good time. And today I'll tell you some of what I told the folks this week during my presentation. And I'm also going to throw a book recommendation your way later on in the program, which I kind of forgot to do on stage. So you'll be the first to hear that one. And right now, let's talk about the stuff that I've been talking about all week here in Las Vegas. So for the past 3 years, my message has been pretty consistent, and you'll recognize some pieces of it. I've got some new stuff to add to it, but the overall message, I think you will recognize in many cases. But I got some really cool stuff. First of all, the very first thing I want to talk to anybody about these days is, of course, the biggest bubble in history, bigger than the dot-com bubble, bigger than the housing bubble, and that is the bond market, the global bond market. Of course, we're right around $15 trillion of negative-yielding sovereign debt in the world. The biggest chunk of that is Japanese government bonds, and then the rest are all European bonds. And it's just to think that people are approaching these sovereign debt instruments, which is supposed to be the safest stuff in the world, with the same fervor as they were buying dot-com stocks in, 1999 and 2000, is a little insane. Turning these safe instruments into toxic waste is just a moment of, it is the most insane moment, certainly, of my career in financial markets. So what do you buy? What do you buy when you can't buy the safe sovereign debt? Well, the bond fund managers are buying that stuff because they're having the greatest year of their life. And they're also buying, if you can't get positive yield on a 50-year bond, what do you buy? You buy the 100-year bond yielding 1%. Austria came out with a 100-year bond this summer that yields 1%. And, 1% for 100 years, who could resist? Right? The proposition is irresistibly sexy. And of course, this summer, Bloomberg came out with a piece that said century bonds having a moment as JP Morgan and other asset managers load up on this stuff. And they pointed out that the century bonds, the 100-year bonds, have returned almost double the emerging market benchmark. Right? So what's happening there is it's a classic scramble for yield. While these guys are having this career-making year and they need to buy something with a positive spread, positive spread over like the benchmark, the emerging market benchmarks. And so they're just going nuts. It's a classic yield grab, right? Reaching for yield is something you will hear. I bet you every Stansberry analyst has used the phrase reaching for yield to identify one of the biggest mistakes you could ever make in your life with real money. And this, century bond article that came out in, July, it contained this sentence that was crazy, right? These people are scrambling for yield. They're buying this stuff that yields 1% for 100 years. And this sentence blew me away. It said that the managers acknowledged they would get slaughtered if the Fed shocks markets by not lowering borrowing costs. So, hey, it's supposed to be the safest thing to yield, but it's more like a dot-com stock. And if the central banks don't cooperate, we'll get slaughtered, but I'm going to get the biggest bonus ever if this works out as of December 31st. That is the state of things in the bond market. And of course, we've also talked about, haven't we, corporate debt with negative yields, right? So you have a whole country that can print its own currency, issuing bonds in its own currency, and those are negative yielding. But then when a corporation, all that's behind that is the corporation, its earnings and its ability to pay its bills. And if something bad happens to the business, they can't print their own money the way a country can. So who would buy a negative yielding corporate debt instrument? I'm not really sure. And then, of course, I covered this in the What's New segment that we used to do. remember the story about the sub-zero European junk bonds. There were 14 companies this summer with sub-zero yields in junk bonds. So you buy junk bonds because they yield more than other stuff because they're riskier. And now they yield nothing. You pay to own them, same as with all this other stuff. But they're not anywhere like safe. They're not, you know, investment grade corporates. They're not sovereigns. They're junk. That's why they call them that. Insane. But the one that really caught my eye, for some reason, it kind of tickled my funny bone, was a story in August of a bank called Berlin Hyp, spelled H-Y-P, a real estate and mortgage bank in Berlin. And the Financial Times headline said, Berlin Hyp sells 1 billion euro mortgage bond at record negative yield. Record negative yield, the most negative yield. And in the story, in the Financial Times, I was gobsmacked by the proximity of the words considered particularly safe to the words sub-zero yield, lowest in history. And they said that the bonds are backed by both the issuer and pools of residential and commercial mortgages. Check. Good. Considered particularly safe. Got it. But you're guaranteed to lose money. Now, normally, when things are safe and backed by the issuer, and it's a good issuer like this bank, and they're backed by solid residential and commercial mortgages, what they're telling you is that you're highly likely not to lose any money. You're highly likely to make money owning this thing. But here the guarantee is you are absolutely, definitely going to lose money if you buy this bond. It's bizarre. We're in bizarro world land. It's true insanity. And yet, of course, what did the article say? It said Berlin Hyp said it received such strong demand for the debt that it was able to make the bond offering a jumbo above 1 billion total. 1 billion euro total for the first time in 6 years. So you can picture this, right? You know, two guys running this Berlin mortgage bank, you know, Fritz and Otto, Friday afternoon, spitballing ideas, breaking out the schnapps maybe, lighting up a cigar. And Fritz is like, oh, you know, Otto, we have to do something. We have to get a deal into the bond market, you know, something big, something really big. This negative yielding scam is the biggest scam in the history of scams, and I want a piece of the action. You know what I'm saying? Yeah, Fritz, I know what you're saying. What do you have in mind? Well, you know, I'm thinking like 1 billion euro, you know? Something huge. Yeah, sounds good. What do you think for the pricing, yeah? I'm thinking for the pricing, we stick it to them good and hard. You know what I'm saying? Maybe we go 50, 60 negative basis points. You know what I'm saying? And it's like that, isn't it? It's like a manhood measuring contest in the bond market. Who can go most negative? Who can make bondholders pay the most to lend them money? Genuine moment of sheer insanity. And there's no technical finance. Sure, there are reasons why people are holding these things and buying them. Partly because they keep going up, the yields keep getting more negative, and the bond fund managers are doing great, and they have assets to allocate, and they want to get a bonus. But there's no secret technical reason. You're not missing anything, in other words. It really is that crazy. It's as crazy as it looks. And one Bloomberg article said, paying a company to lend to it for 2 to 5 years is preferable to accepting below zero yields on German government debt for 3 decades. Right. That was a German bond fund manager. That's the mentality. That's what they're doing. And I couldn't help sharing a tweet from maybe a month ago. Mario Draghi says negative rates will not provoke the collapse of the financial system. Well, who brought up the collapse of the financial system? I didn't say anything about that. Did you? Look, this is classic. This is a classic signal. It's like when a country says we will not devalue the currency. Get the hell out. They're going to devalue the currency, right? So he's saying, what he's really saying is when negative rates lead to the collapse of the financial system, don't blame it on us. That's how you parse that statement. And of course, we also heard over the summer, didn't we, that all the discussion about the U.S. is next. Right? All our debt, all the sovereign debt in the U.S. is still positive yielding. right? It's still, you get paid to lend money to the U.S. government still. But the expectation is that this won't always be the case, that our yields will go negative as well. I don't know. I really don't. Frankly, I think the likely future course of interest rates resembles a Jackson Pollock painting, you know? It's just scribbles and lines on the wall. Who knows? Who knows where it'll wind up? But it's insane. And of course, it's no surprise to you that when I got to talking about stocks, you know, they're enormously expensive. You know, earlier this year, we saw that wonderful picture that went around the internet of the line of 200 people to get to the top of Mount Everest. I mean, what a metaphor for the stock market, right? It's crowded at the top. And this guy, Peter Hackett, clinical professor, University of Colorado, School of Medicine, Department of Pulmonary Sciences. So he knows what he's talking about. He says you're slowly dying above 18,000 feet, but when you get above 26,000 feet, you start dying much more quickly. So that's probably the conversation at the top of Mount Everest. Excuse me, you appear to be dying a little more slowly than me. I think I'm dying faster than you. Can I get in front of you? And that's what it's like when you're paying more than 2x sales for the S&P 500. This has only happened one other time, at the top of the dot-com bubble. That's when stocks were this expensive before. You know, 2x sales. And the price-to-sales ratio in the S&P 500 is better. It's a better determinant, or it has been historically. That's the proper way to say this. Historically, when the S&P 500 has gotten above 2x sales, it's been a disaster. And when it's gotten anywhere near there, right, it's only been above 2x once, but when it's gotten anywhere near there in the past, it's been a disaster too. So, and of course, people love it, right? That's when they're most excited about stocks. They're lighting money on fire and loving it. And then when it's, you know, below 1x sales at the bottom of bear markets, people are too busy changing their underwear 5x a day to notice the bargain and take advantage of it. But, and the other way, I think, to look at the overall stock market that makes sense is the old Ben Graham, Warren Buffett. Stock market capitalization as a percentage of gross domestic product, right? Stock market cap to GDP. And in the United States, that's pushing up towards 160%, all-time high. It's like 157, I think, right now. I'm just kind of eyeballing the chart. It's getting close to 160. But just above 150, I mean, that's really insane. It was like under 150 at the top of the dot-com bubble. So, you know, we're in rarefied territory here in the stock market, no matter what anyone tells you. All this stuff about, you know, as long as interest rates stay low, you know, stocks are cheap. That makes no sense whatsoever. Okay. Also, for the last couple of years at this event, I have been talking about private equity as a kind of a sell signal. That's where you really tend to see the froth, because it's an exercise in chasing risk to get more return, you know, among well-heeled investors who can put, you know, 5, 10, 20, 25 million into a private equity fund. So 2 years ago in 2017, I threw up a slide of a Financial Times article that said private equity fundraising hits post-crisis high. They raised like $240 billion, a lot of money. And of course, they lever it up, you know, 5, 6, 7x too, right? And then, of course, the following year, I put up a slide that says, what? What would the next thing be? Well, a record $2.5 trillion in mergers announced the first half of 2018. That follows from the headline of the previous year. And this year, private equity races to spend record $2.5 trillion cash pile, deal-making at highest level since lead-up to financial crisis. That's the Financial Times just recently here. But the most interesting way of looking at this, and I freely admit, I got this off of Twitter, and I thought it was slightly brilliant. Now, I kind of added to it. I fleshed it out more, but it was just an idea that somebody kind of threw out. And it turns out it looks right to me. And the basic idea is that Blackstone is the second biggest private equity firm in the world, next to second only to Apollo. And when they find new creative ways to sell their equity, that's, you know, they want to sell into a frenzy. Because what is private equity? Well, they buy public companies and they turn them a liquid asset into an illiquid asset that's leveraged up. So when markets start getting frothy, they need to find a way to sell, so they sell their own shares. So part one of this was that first run-up in 1998 during the dot-com bubble. You got that run-up in the summertime right before the Russian crisis hit and long-term capital hit. And at that time, Blackstone sold 7% of itself. It was still a private company. They sold 7% of itself to AIG right in that frenzy. And, of course, the market topped out within 2 years. and it was a huge, huge bear market. So fast forward to 2007, right near the top of the housing bubble. That's when they went public. They sold 12% of the stock to the public. Okay, fast forward to now. And in July, they turned from, they were a publicly traded partnership, and most index funds and mutual funds do not like to have these publicly traded partnership shares in their fund. It's weird for taxes, so they don't do it. So what's the frenzy right now that Blackstone wants to sell into? Well, it's index funds, right? People are gaga for index funds. You know, the S&P 500 has turned into like the, you know, that's really the alpha, the outperformance of the index has kind of become the alpha almost. So the extra return above the market is now the extra return above the market. It's weird. So what did they do? They turned into a regular corporation. They ditched the partnership structure. And that was the headline in Dealbook in the New York Times. They said, Blackstone will ditch partnership structure to draw more investors. And the switch came on July 1st, right before the market fell apart in August. I mean, these guys are uncanny. And who knows? What are we? Is this like the 1998 moment? Are we within, you know, less than 2 years of a big top? I don't know, but it wouldn't surprise me at all. Maybe I'm reading too much into it. But I will tell you one thing. Nobody is worried. All year long, I've been seeing these headlines. And I've got all these on slides in front of me. I'll just read them to you. Like Fox Business, is inflation really dead? CNBC, Ed Yardeni says, I think inflation is dead. Bloomberg Businessweek, cover of Bloomberg Businessweek, April 22nd edition. Is inflation dead? Bloomberg in April, did capitalism kill inflation? The disappearance of the age-old bogeyman confounds central bankers and economists. And if you look at the inflation expectations ETF, the ticker symbol is RINF, it's way the heck down. And, you know, like look at a 5 or 6 year chart, maybe go back to like 2012, 2013. And the thing is just down, down, down. It was well above 40 back then. It's around 25 now. And so definitely the inflation expectations ETF, not expecting inflation. And yet, stuff you want to buy costs more. Rents are up. Healthcare's through the roof. The stock market is way up and the bond market is way up. I mean, there's inflation somewhere, right? But nobody's worried. If you look at the Merrill Lynch, Bank of America Merrill Lynch has these things called the Global Financial Stress Indexes. And there are three of them. There's the basic index, then there's the market index and liquidity index, and they're all low, low, and low. And the Michigan Consumer Sentiment Indexes, there are three of those, and they're high, high, and high. Now, if you look at the charts a little bit, maybe the financial stress indexes are kind of curling up a little, and maybe the sentiment indexes are curling down a little bit. But frankly, if you look at the history of the volatility of it, it could just be noise. I mean, it could just be nothing. And nobody, it seems worried. And so, you know, I put this slide up that says something in Latin. It says, cum stercore micellam ventilandum fugit. My Latin pronunciation is nothing, okay? I'm just, you know, spitballing here. I don't really know what I'm doing. But the reason why I put that up is because I can't say stercore because it's a naughty word. It's the stuff that hits the fan. It's the bovine excrement that hits the fan and flies. That's what I want to remind people of when the financial stress index is low and the consumer sentiment index is high and markets are in the stratosphere, the stock and bond markets, in the stratosphere. And of course, you know, another theme, I look like an idiot doing this to some people I know, but I got to do it. Owning the best stocks won't save you. And Rudy Havenstein off of Twitter reminded us of the Silicon Valley Business Journal article, March 19th, 2000, headline, Firm's Market Cap Climbing to $1 Trillion. It was an article about Cisco Systems, the dot-com darling stock, the no-brainer that everyone would thought was the greatest business in the world, and there's no way owning that is ever going to work out poorly. It peaked at $80. It bottomed out almost 90% below that. You know, it was a terrible, the no-brainers are terrible investments. And indeed, the largest market cap companies in the world, they're called top dogs. And Rob Arnott from Research Affiliates has done really terrific research on this stuff. Research affiliates, if you go to researchaffiliates.com, you can read some stuff and make up your own mind about what you think. But they're a top-notch research firm. I don't care what anybody says. And everybody says that, so it's not like, you know, everybody's not saying it. But Arnott looked at this stuff, and he said, yeah, the top dogs, if you have like a global sort of market cap weighted type portfolio, like in a big fund, and then you sort of just take the top market cap companies, the top 10, they're remarkably inconsistent. The decade by decade analysis shows that typically only two of the top 10 companies remain among the largest companies 10 years later. They're constantly changing places because they underperform. Top dogs vanish from the top dogs list because they underperform. The global top dog outpaced the global cap-weighted stock market only 5% of the time in the last 30 years. Arnott says it delivered annual shortfall of 10.5% per year, roughly equivalent to losing 2/3 of its value. So, you know, everybody, it's like Howard Marks says, you know, if everybody already thinks it's the greatest business in the world, then, you know, everybody who's going to buy it has bought it. And that affects the return going forward. And so I think you got to have, what have I been telling you that Howard Marks also says? You got to have an imagination. You lack imagination if you can't imagine Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Netflix, Google seriously underperforming starting right about now. And so there's a report by a group called Aoris Investment Management. It's free, Aoris, A-O-R-I-S. You can Google it. And it's called Fangs, the Sun Has Set on Their Days of Dominance. You know, I won't read from the report, but it's good to exercise your imagination. And believe me, I know these are the greatest businesses in the world too. That's not the point. This is investing. It's about making money. It's not about, you know, collecting the shiniest objects, you know, and having your friends be jealous of you, right? It's about making money. And when the best business is known by everyone on earth for a decade to be the best business, it tends not to be a great bet anymore. You know, you can say, well, Dan, you know, this is like the third year in a row you're talking like this, and the market's been going up pretty much the whole time. I hear you. I do. I hear you. But the excesses are still there. And I'm not calling a top at a particular moment. I'm identifying risk, which I think is extraordinarily more important and doable. Identifying risk is doable. Calling tops, not so doable. Not worth the effort, really, at all. So, you know, I think one of the signals we're getting here is from the IPO market, right? And as I've said, like the vision and growth IPO market is dead and WeWork killed it. And I've talked about WeWork, so I don't need to go through. I put up a bunch of slides this week in Vegas, and it's the same situation that I've described in Stansberry Digest, the Daily Digest, and on this program in the past. Basically, if you had a vision, it didn't matter if you were losing money hand over fist, $1 billion a year. As long as you could show rapid revenue growth and some flowery vision of the world, you could get funding in the venture capital market and go public. Well, I think the failure of WeWork to go public and, you know, the ouster, really, I mean, he stepped down, but, you know, he was ousted of the WeWork founder and CEO, Adam Neumann. I think this is kind of, it's a very toppy looking moment to me. And you can see it in the WeWork bond prices. They're making new lows as I speak to you below 85. And it was, the 7 7/8 bond, which matures May of 2025 from WeWork, it hit 105 in August 15th, just a few pennies shy of 105, and now it's below 85, like that quick. And if you look at a chart, it looks like it's fallen off a cliff. Like people are saying, oh, wait a minute, this might be a zero. And I contend, and I told the audience this week in Vegas, that WeWork securities are not appropriate for the portfolios of mammals, reptiles, marine animals, or birds. Who can buy this stuff? Cockroaches. A cockroach can survive a week without a head because they breathe through their body, apparently. And the only reason they die is because they can't drink without a head. They can't survive without water for a week. So, you know, something that can survive a week without a head, it can survive 30 minutes submerged underwater. That sucker can buy a WeWork bond. That's a pretty tough dude. He can take it. But you and I and marine animals, birds, reptiles, we can't buy them. They're just not appropriate for other species. And of course, you know, Masayoshi Son has this vision fund, right? Vision and Growth is dead, and the vision fund is suffering. They're going to have to do write-downs because, you know, they put money in Uber and Slack, and those guys went public and are way down, you know, Uber's way down from their IPO price. WeWork never went public, and the valuation peaked when SoftBank put $2 billion into it in January. It was $47 billion valuation at that time. And I bet you that even if they wanted to go forward with this thing, they would have trouble getting $10 billion. And SoftBank put in $11 billion. Really tragic circumstances there. I mean, it's kind of a typical thing, isn't it? You know, this guy has all these big home runs, and then he raises $1 billion and puts it into all this garbage, and, you know, they're not home runs. They're the opposite of their strikeouts, you know? And he had plans for a second vision fund. And of course, they're scrapped, right? You can't do it again. I mean, these things are such pristine, toppy-looking moments. Maybe I'm too much wanting to call, you know, the top secretly, right? Even though I refuse to actually do that because I know it's an exercise in futility. You know, so I'm only human. I'm probably drawn, I'm biased toward my own viewpoint, right? So it sounds like it's all bad news. I wouldn't really say that because I think you can position yourself properly. I think you can diversify adequately. And I think I've actually hit on a decent diversification strategy that is really simple because for, you know, since May of 2017, I've been saying the same thing. Hold plenty of cash, hold gold, and buy value when and where you find it. So, you know, cash sort of takes care of you in a deflationary situation. Gold takes care of you in an inflationary or, you know, financial distress kind of a situation. And, you know, your equity exposure, if you pick it right, takes care of you all basically all the rest of the time. You know, I don't advocate like selling it all and heading out to the hinterlands with gold, guns, and groceries. Although I did joke to that effect earlier this week. I don't really think you should do that. I think you should stick with the same plan. Plenty of cash, plenty of gold, buy value where you find it. And the moment that I've been sort of predicting, like 2 years ago, I was determined to be patient and do it right. And 2 years ago, I started saying, you know, I think there's going to be a new golden age of value coming at some point here because value has underperformed for so long. And I said the same thing again next year. I said, not here yet. I'll let you know. But this year, I think it happened starting on September 9th, and we've discussed it in a previous podcast. And during the month of September, you know, the Russell 1000 value kind of, it's an okay benchmark. It's not ideal, but it's okay, the value indexes versus like the Russell 1000 growth. You know, there's significant outperformance, which is like, you know, it's about 2% outperformance, which, you know, you get several months of that or a few months of that every year for 5 or 6 years, you know, then you're talking substantial outperformance, right? So it's only 1 month, and we have seen this action before since about 2016. 2016 was a good year for it. I could have made the call then, but I really didn't think it was the right moment. But I do think it's here now, and part of my greater confidence is in, you know, WeWork kind of ripping the IPO market a new one and the absurdities in the bond market. It can always get more absurd, and you won't hear me making an outright prediction or calling tops. You know, I'm just trying to kind of weight the risks and figure out what's the best thing to do. And I never want to be, you know, the fanatical gold, guns, and groceries guy, okay? So I think you can buy value stocks. You can do more classic value strategies, which it reduces to like a screen. You know, I haven't cared about value screens for many, many years. And we've been using some more sophisticated techniques to try to gauge the market's expectations for a company's growth, you know, versus what our expectations were. And when we found a big discrepancy, we said, hey, this is a buy, you know. And we had some good results with that. I think so far, Starbucks has been the best one. It was up 80% in less than a year after we We found it. So I think now I'm starting to do more screening with like enterprise value to EBITDA, price to free cash flow, even, you know, PE ratio. I kind of look at that and I'm like, there's a lot of noise in earnings, so in net earnings numbers. So kind of scrap that one. But I think EV to EBITDA is like the new PE for basic, good old fashioned value screening. And of course, you get most of it's garbage, right? You have to do a lot of mining. You know, it's a mining operation. You take a ton of earth and you sift through it for a gram of gold. But I think there are a lot of grams of gold in there these days. And I think we found one that's going to be in the next issue of Extreme Value. So, you know, not trying to sell you Extreme Value. I'm just saying we're starting along this pathway. I'm assuming that you know, value is kind of back and that money will flow out of those FANG names and growthier names as it did in September into the value names. You know, on balance, not in a straight line, for the next few to several years, I'll say. And that's really all I told them, right? The bond market's the biggest bubble ever. Stocks are exorbitantly more expensive than most people really think, in my opinion. And private equity is a weird sell signal. But of course, yes, I've been saying these things for 3 years, but I think they've all intensified and become more concentrated now. And I think it's time to get a little more cautious. Make sure you're holding gold. Make sure you're holding cash and buying value when and where you find it. And that's the message for this week. I'm going to leave you there. And by all means, write into feedback@investorhour.com. Let me know what you think. And let me know in particular, if you think that saying this stuff for 3 years running means I'm wrong, you know, I welcome your questions, comments, and politely worded criticism. So, and you guys have been really great at honoring that request. And I've gotten plenty of criticism, but all of it politely worded, like 99.9% of it. So, you know, let's talk about this. Write in and let's talk about it. Because this is, you know, it's all an ongoing process, right? Okay, I almost forgot. I promised you a book recommendation, did I not, at the beginning of the program? And the book is called How We Learn, The Surprising Truth About When, Where, and Why It Happens. The author is Benedict Carey, C-A-R-E-Y, Carey. And Carey is a writer for the New York Times, so the book is really well written, and you kind of breeze through it. It's full of stories and ideas. But I actually have some experience with the principles because I was taught some of them a long time ago when I was studying music in college. And my teacher told me, said, you know, you're going to be a music major. I want you to practice like 4 hours a day. Don't do it all at once. Break up the practice sessions. And Carey recommends the same thing in the book. And he presents all kinds of research, which is actually available in other books. There's a book called Make It Stick that deals with the same topics. There's another book by Barbara Oakley called A Mind for Numbers that deals with studying math and science using many of the same principles. But I definitely recommend the Carey book more, How We Learn. It's just an easier read, and I think you'll be inspired. I was inspired to pick up the principles and use them to learn things and change my life and change my routines a little bit to exploit them. And I think you will be too. How We Learn by Benedict Carey. Highly recommend it. All right. Now it's time to get back to this conversation that we have every week in the mailbag. Write into us, feedback@investorhour.com, with questions, comments, and politely worded criticisms. And I will read every single one of them, including the Russian spam. And I won't be able to respond to every single one, but I'll read them all and I'll respond to as many as I can until we become so popular that I get 1,000 a day and can't possibly read them all. But we're not quite there yet, okay? I'm going to go through a selection of these. We got a lot of feedback about the change in format, right? We're doing the interview and mailbag 1 week, and then we're doing my rant, monologue, weekly perturbation, whatever you want to call it, and mailbag the next week. And our plan is to go back and forth. I have to tell you, some people like the old format better, Some people really like the new one. It's kind of mixed. We're going to continue until we see a clear reason to change EAT back or into something that we think is even better. So the first mailbag item we have this week is from Dan S. And Dan S. says, "Hi, Dan, I love your show and look forward to each weekly episode. You mentioned the shift from growth to value that took place in September. Is there a way to determine which stocks in my portfolio are value stock, which may do better in the coming months and years, and which are growth stocks? Most of my portfolio is comprised of Stansberry recommendations, and it would be good to know which positions to sell or reduce. By the way, I met you in Baltimore in January in the taping of the Bulls versus Bears Summit, Dan S." Well, it was good to meet you, Dan, and thank you for writing in. So the perspective here is, you know, the idea of looking and say, well, which of my stocks are growth and which are value, and I want to sell the growth or reduce the growth. I would simply act like you have to buy them all over again, which you should be doing anyway. You know, every now and then you want to take a look at things and say, how has this business changed? And I wouldn't use the top-down idea of the shift from growth to value to jettison, to just knee-jerk jettison individual names. Remember, every stock you own is a piece of a business. Think about the business. Think about whether or not you want to own that business. That would be my advice. I wouldn't necessarily listen to me saying that and say, well, I got to get rid of the growthy stuff. You got to think about what you own frequently anyway. Just do that, and I think you'll be okay. Okay, so Brendan K. writes in and said, Brendan, I'm sorry, I'm not able to read your whole email. So it was kind of long, but you had a good question here, so I wanted to get to that, okay? And it says, Dan, I have a question for you in regards to, quote, winter coming, end quote. It is said that recession hits when no one sees it coming. Given the uncertainty and now risen talk about the possibilities of an economic downturn, is it more likely that a recession doesn't occur so soon? Or have we, economists and the public, finally seen the story, that is, inverted yield curve, historically low employment, enough times that we have learned through our failures and have finally taken notice? In many investing books that I've read, the mantra has been repeated, just when you expect X, the opposite of X occurs. Nevertheless, and at the same time, do you think that the increase in talks about a possible recession will cause a recession or economic slowdown itself? Would love to hear your opinion if you get a chance. Best regards, Brendan K. Thank you, Brendan. First of all, first things first, no, I do not think talking about a recession will cause a recession. You can talk all you want, but if you still have a job and life is still good, you're going to spend your money, period. That's it. And that's how the economy is measured. It's measured in spending. People keep doing it as long as things look good to them. And remember, the consumer indexes are all, you know, they're high. And the financial stress indexes are all low. So I don't think we can talk ourselves into a recession. I think it's baloney. Even though you saw that idea in the press, I thought it was baloney the whole time. Okay, now, your other question here is a good one. I like it. Right when you expect X and when everybody's talking about it, the opposite occurs. And I think you're right. I think that's the right perspective. If you go to Google Trends, which I believe is trends.google.com, you can find out what people are searching for. And in that third or sort of middle week of August there, when the market was looking really ugly, the search trend shot straight up to the moon on the word recession. And it's kind of back down now. But people are still, you know, you still see people talking about it on the news. So I think it's still out there and it's still, people are still too concerned with it for me to really be concerned with it. I agree with you. I think that's exactly the way it is. And I expect that a recession will hit us when we're not looking for it. Okay, next one is from Dan K. And Dan K. says, hello, big fan of the show. I'm still on the fence with the new format. Let's see how it plays out. I missed hearing all four segments this week, but I'm a fan of being open-minded and trust your judgment. Real quick, so hopefully you can read the whole email. With the recent lack of liquidity news in the repo markets, it made me wonder about the money market funds that sit in retirement accounts. A fairly large portion of our family retirement is sitting in a retirement account that doesn't allow you to truly hold cash, but instead a money market fund. What are the impacts and/or risks in today's age of negative rates, liquidity crunches, and impending credit cycle rolling over? Thanks, Dan K. I didn't want to knee-jerk react to this because the repo market is it's an opaque thing. It's like this financial utility that happens where, you know, companies fund themselves with these repurchase agreements collateralized by bonds. And a couple of things I noticed. First of all, when the repo market rates went overnight, shot from 2 to 2.5% up to 10%, and then, you know, the Fed injected tens of billions of liquidity to help out with it, there was an absolute avalanche of people on Twitter and in the press saying, oh, it's not a big deal. I found that suspicious. And the smartest thing I've heard said about this is, here's this behind-the-scenes little financial utility thing that happens that nobody ever thinks about, and it's opaque. And, you know, the interest rate quadruples overnight. That could be a problem. All of a sudden, you're hearing about this thing you're never supposed to hear about because it's so plain vanilla, meaningless, boring. That's all I'm going to say about it right now. I need to think about it some more and think about your question. But with any money market fund, get the ticker symbol, get the information from the fund company, and find out what's in it. Because money market encompasses a wide array of instruments, you know, and repos can be in there. And there's a lot of other stuff that can be in there. So just do some homework. And I'm going to leave you with that, Dan. I hope that's a good enough answer. If it's not, write back in and we'll talk more about it. Okay, so Bill H., you wrote me a nice, thoughtful, long email, and I'm telling you, Bill, I'm going to read one sentence, and I thank you for it. You said, in my opinion, Greta Thunberg, who I criticized, the 16-year-old environmental activist that addressed the United Nations a little while ago, and I thought it was just over the top. Bill H. says, in my opinion, Greta needs to be treated as your favorite singer, songwriter, or poet, rather than compared to a chemist teaching at a prestigious university. Bill H., you nailed it. You're absolutely right. I took myself too seriously about Greta. And I think because of that, readers reacted and they took themselves too seriously and criticized me a little sharply. But one reader said, you know, you called her an idiot and that's wrong. If I call Greta an idiot, I don't want to do that. I don't want to be that guy. She's 16. She doesn't know what she's talking about. I'm sorry. One guy wrote in and said, it's high school chemistry and she knows what she's talking about. She doesn't. You're wrong. It's not high school. You're trying to predict an apocalyptic event by extrapolating data into the future. It's too complex. It can't be done that easily, and certainly not by a high school kid. However, Bill H. is right. I shouldn't have taken it so seriously, and I think that's where I'm going to leave that. Okay, so one more from Steve C. Steve says, following up on a previous listener's question, how are online brokers making money if the equity transactions are free? In the words of Andrew Lewis, if you're not paying for it, you're not the customer, you're the product being sold. So how are brokerage houses now making money on me? Really good question. Thanks, Steve C. Really good question, Steve C. They can make money on order flow. You know, they can route your orders to a market maker who can earn a spread. That's one way to do it. And, you know, there's probably other ways that I'm not thinking of. But that was the first thing I thought of as soon as I read about it. And you're right. You know, you're the product being sold. They want to churn your account so they can get spreads. And I'm sure there are other things they can do, too, that I'm just not thinking of. So great question. And it's one you ought to think about, you know. And don't do more buying and selling because the commissions are zero. That's silly. You buy and sell when it makes sense to buy and sell, not because commissions are low or non-existent in this case. Well, that's it. That's another episode of the Stansberry Investor Hour. It's my privilege to come to you once again this week, as it is every week, and I thank you for listening. And look, I want to hear from you. This thing that we do at the end of every show is a conversation. It's a two-way thing. So write into feedback@investorhour.com. Let me know what you're thinking. You know, comment on the format. Keep me in the loop there. Okay, I want to know what you're thinking about that because we want this thing to work for you. If it works for you, then it works, right? And if you want me to do people have said, I want you to do a rant every week because I love it. And if you really want that, then, you know, I should buck up and do it. So write in feedback@investorhour.com. And you can go to that same web address, investorhour.com. You can enter your email and you can get updates on all the future episodes. And you can go to that same address too, and you can see every episode we've ever done. You can see a transcript for every episode we've ever done. Pretty cool. Thank you so much. I'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to the Stansberry Investor Hour. To access today's notes and receive notice of upcoming episodes, go to investorhour.com and enter your email. Have a question for Dan? Send him an email at feedback@investorhour.com. This broadcast is provided for entertainment purposes only and should not be considered personalized investment advice. Trading stocks and all other financial instruments involves risk. You should not make any investment decision based solely on what you hear. Stansberry Investor Hour is produced by Stansberry Research and is copyrighted by the Stansberry Radio Network.